Now, we know that schizophrenia occurs in all socioeconomic groups, but I want to talk about with you initially the African-American adolescents in the United States with whom you've done so much specialist work. Mm. What is happening in their context in terms of the experience of mental health issues and schizophrenia in particular, whether you feel they're a more at-risk community or what's really happening for them?
I worked at Boston Medical Center for several years and just ended my term there back in 2007. But I've been following a lot of what's been going on in the urban community in Boston and generally speaking around the country, particularly in Boston and for most major cities, not just cities, but also rural communities, that one of the things that's become one of our greatest concerns has become the extensive amount of violence, particularly gun violence, that we're seeing around the country. And just 2 weeks ago, we had a situation in a rural part of Illinois where a young high school student shot three of his classmates. And so this has been an ongoing problem in the U.S. for at least a decade, with kids going to school armed with guns and having all sorts of shootings that have taken place. And I'm sure you've probably heard of the Virginia Tech College situation that occurred, where there was quite a few students were killed. It was almost a massacre. So it's a national problem. It's a problem that's really a primary concern. One of my concerns also is the extent to which this has become a major problem for communities. And black youth I think the media has over-identified black youth with the amount of gun violence that's taken place in our urban cities across the U.S.
Yes, one of the things that interests me is that another guest on my program has made the point that people with schizophrenia in particular, but perhaps it could apply to mental health issues in general, are more often likely to be the victims of crime rather than the perpetrators of crime. Can we talk about that from what your context is telling you?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I think only 1% of the population, people in the population, have schizophrenia. So in some ways, we're making a direct correlation with violence and aggressive behavior as, you know, in the image of people who we visualize as people who are least able to take care of themselves. So what I'm trying to say is, when we think of schizophrenia, we have this sort of stereotypical image, kind of stigmatized image of people who are violent and aggressive and they can't take care of themselves at the same time. So it's particularly disturbing that African-American youth have been at the forefront of this with gang activities and the spike in community violence. In a way, almost parallels the kind of ongoing increase in poverty and the lack of resources that many youth and their families experience. And so the outward manifestation of this frustration, in my mind, is often seen in gang-related activities, sometimes in gun violence. It's almost like it's the tipping point of a larger issue. And the issue in my mind isn't schizophrenia as much as it is incredible levels of chronic poverty and trauma, meaning trauma from the kind of gun activities that people have experienced in their communities, and sort of trauma that people experience from having to deal with violence every day. Chronic poverty, violence, these are the kinds of things that people are grappling with that feel like they have very few resources to help them get themselves out of a hole or get themselves beyond or to a point of feeling more stable.
Can I just clarify, you were saying before that African-American youth are accused of more gun violence. Are you saying that this is an unfair accusation, that in fact communities where African-American families are living may have violence as a response to violence in the community more broadly? Can we just look at that a bit more closely, please?
Well, I think there's a kind of hypervigilance among the media or from the media, particularly toward African-American communities in which there has been, and it's documented, we know that, a greater amount of community violence, particularly gun violence. The idea that the gang problem has been a growing problem for over a decade now, and we see it in all the major cities. My hunch is, and certainly, you know, I've done some reading on this, is that the gang activity has to do with a number of things. It has to do with a deeper sense of isolation. It's more like of internal isolation. And so youth band with other youth who have similar thoughts, similar ideas. I think we've kind of lost hope of really being able to work with these youth and really get at what are the values, or really work with lifting up the values that they were raised with, and using those values as a means of motivating them to do other kinds of things. One of the things I find really interesting in terms of gun violence and even drug activity is that some of the people that are organizing gangs or selling drugs are unbelievable business entrepreneurs. And so if you could take those set of skills, that skill set, and flip it so that some of these youth are engaged in activities that are more pro-social, you know, responsible, also ways of helping other people, and as well as helping themselves, they would be model citizens. But what we have is a more sort of antisocial, a more sort of criminal aspect. We see the more criminal aspects of the skills that they have. And in the end, it ends up undermining, I think, them, and also creating a certain kind of stigma for Black equals angry, violent, out of control behavior. One of the interesting things is that Jonathan Metzl is a psychiatry professor at the University of Michigan, and he wrote a book a few years ago called The Protest Psychosis, How Schizophrenia Became a Black Disease. And in the book, Metzl writes about how the understanding of schizophrenia has changed throughout the 20th century from a sort of white middle class woman's disease where the person went to an inpatient hospital or center to kind of recoup, to an African American man's disease. And he talks about how this, the conflict born out of the civil rights movement gave rise to this understanding in our culture where we associate angry Black men as being mentally unstable or having schizophrenia. And in this way, this thinking, certainly he's arguing, has influenced the way doctors interpret and diagnose schizophrenia. So after the civil rights movement, that anger, that kind of violence that came out of the civil rights movement became sort of the stamp of mental illness for the Black or African American male.
Well, how does this work then for an African American male who is experiencing schizophrenia? How does that work in terms of the appropriate diagnosis and appropriate intervention and support? What's your experience of that?
As you are hinting at, you know, it then becomes a kind of confusing situation. At least in the United States, we have really pulled back in hospitalizing people. But at an earlier phase, certainly, you know, after the civil rights movement, the 60s and the 70s, lots of African-American people were hospitalized and given the tag of schizophrenia. Now, one of the things that we do know is that, at least with the diagnostic manual, the book that psychiatrists use as a kind of reference book, that throughout our history, there's been a kind of focus around certain diagnoses. So in the United States, attention deficit disorder has been one, and bipolar has been another one, a more recent. And one of the things that's happened is that they've formed a kind of cluster and that people are overdiagnosed with those kind of diagnoses. The same sort of thing was happening in the 60s and the 70s with African-American people in general, but particularly males who were angry. So when they were out of control and then hospitalized involuntarily, they often had a diagnosis of schizophrenia. And that's what Jonathan Metzl was referring to. It became the African American men's disease because the greater number of people who were hospitalized were also tagged with that diagnosis. Now, currently, a lot of the Black youth or African American youth who are given diagnosis are given a diagnosis of bipolar disorder or antisocial disorder, which is more criminal kind of behavior, inability to follow rules, social norms. And so most of the angry, quote-unquote, angry African-American youth that we see now are incarcerated. The larger number of them are incarcerated, and fewer are going to hospitals. They're ending up in juvenile centers for longer and longer stays. Some of the ones that I evaluated at Boston Medical Center and certainly worked with at the Department of Youth Services here in Boston, they might have a gun or get involved in some assaultive behavior at 13 or 14 and then get mandated or remanded to DYS until they were 21. So particularly after they've had numerous involvements in which there was criminal behavior, and we actually have a place in Plymouth where there is almost like a lockdown setting where kids are there for a very long time, and it's an acute juvenile detention center. So just to clarify, one of the things, or summarize, what's happening is that these youth, African-American youth, particularly males, are caught earlier and put in the juvenile delinquent system and in detention centers. And so they end up being, they get on that path, and some of them are required to be there till they're 21. And so then they're on that path headed toward prison. I mean, it's sort of a, you know, upward trajectory in which there are not many detours unless the person really gets themselves together in these institutions and wants out in some way.
Then how does the actual support occur if young African-American men in that sort of delinquent system are seriously mentally ill, if their diagnosis is appropriate, they have an illness such as schizophrenia, what supports are in place? Are they allowed to have another kind of setting and support system other than a delinquent system?
Fewer and fewer of them. I mean, there are some mental health services. They certainly get treatment in terms of medication. But the bulk of those, the youth that are there, don't have schizophrenia. They are people who have suffered from chronic depression, perhaps bipolar disorder, from post-traumatic stress, from either domestic violence in their homes or other kinds of things. And for them, most of them, those diagnoses are really difficult for them, a lot of them to handle, and they reject it. And so that some of them, a lot of them, are not medicated. The more severe young men who are in the system who are psychotic are treated. But this is a smaller number of them that are treated with antipsychotic medication. But by and large, in the United States, only 1% of Americans have the diagnosis of schizophrenia, and that's about 2.2 million people. And the cost to the United States for their care, housing, and certainly medication, and for some, you know, therapy or cognitive behavior therapy in groups, is $63 billion a year. So we're talking about a cost that's really, you know, exorbitant. And of that 1% of Americans, African Americans are 1.5 times more likely to have schizophrenia. So we are over included in that group. And so part of the challenge is sort of sorting out who should be there and who it should not be. And when it comes to males, people have a tendency to look at these behavioral outbursts that sometimes might be a manifestation of other things. And if I could just add one more point, that in terms of schizophrenia, one of the things that we know is it's not one distinct disorder. It's really a very complex disorder that consists of several different other disorders. And some of the new research suggests that one of the things that might be helpful is to begin to look at people earlier. So when I mentioned a few minutes ago about African-American youth that might begin to get involved with the Department of Youth Services at age 13, that we don't really know what's going on for that kid at 13. What we do respond to is the out-of-control behavior that might be criminal behavior or criminal activity. And there are evaluations that take place, but the focus is really a combination of things, of trying to contain the person in their behavior and also doing an evaluation. I'm not sure how well we do with this. I think the fact that we have so many African-American men, period, in prison in the United States suggests to me that some of those people might really have more serious mental illness and shouldn't be there. And I think that's sort of what you might be suggesting.
Can I also check, you said about Jonathan Metzl from the University of Michigan and his point in his research about the almost fashionable focus on certain diagnoses. Has that changed now? Is there a more realistic assessment from what you're describing to me with the statistics, the costs, and the question mark of where some of the people suffering schizophrenia might end up in terms of prison or detention centres or whatever? I get the impression that we now are looking at a more realistic understanding of the incidence and ranges of schizophrenic symptoms across the community in the United States. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and certainly it has changed. I think what he was trying to point to was that for a period of 20 years or so, that there was a really unstable or sort of a fluid understanding of schizophrenia, that it was constantly shifting, and shifting on the basis of what we thought we understood about schizophrenia, with a lot of focus on aggression, hostility, and projection as being one of the clusters of symptoms that might look like schizophrenia. I think now with the research much more sophisticated and research that's looking at the developmental evolution of schizophrenia, that the focus is really trying to see what does this look like earlier in a child's life. And so things like having a genetic predisposition to schizophrenia, meaning a family member that might have had diagnosed with schizophrenia, as well as looking at environmental factors such as stress, ongoing stress, and one of the ones that I add is chronic poverty, because I think that's often missed, that looking at those things as being triggers for a predisposition to schizophrenia.
Can you say a bit more about the chronic poverty as a trigger? In what way might that be the case? Because schizophrenia, as we were saying at the outset, affects all socioeconomic groups in the international community.
When I worked at Boston Medical Center, I saw a number of children and adolescents in the outpatient department, and I also covered the emergency room. And one of the things that became interesting to me and quite disturbing was that each year the rate of homelessness started to get bigger and bigger. So first of all, we'd see people who didn't have a Section 8. Section 8 is sort of a national subsidized housing for low-income people, and you have to document all this paperwork that you're low-income. And once you get a Section 8, you can use it anywhere where the landlord or owner of the property would accept that sort of certificate. And they get the rest. The landlord gets paid from the federal government for your apartment. So the housing stock in Boston has shrunk more and more, and particularly affordable housing. This is a very expensive city. It's probably like Brisbane in that way, or other major cities around the country that are really cosmopolitan. But what we saw in the emergency room, not that that was the place, but that was the place that people came to, were more and more children who were having difficulty in school because they didn't have a really stable environment at home. And it was that people didn't have Section 8s, or they had, if there were four kids in the family or three kids in the family, they were all might be sort of stuck in a two-bedroom apartment with somebody sleeping on the couch or on the floor. And over time, this kind of evolved into then having people say to us, well, we have a Section 8 certificate, but we can't find anybody that will rent to us. Or we can't get a certificate. We have to go into a lottery system because, there are too many people that want a certificate for Section 8 and not enough Section 8, not enough subsidies for it. And then we kind of moved to a place where we were seeing women and children, and with their adolescents as well, coming in saying that they were looking for a shelter. And we, at that point, they usually were single-sex shelters, so that all the women could go in the shelter, so that if you had a male child, adolescent that was 15 or 16 years old, he wouldn't be allowed in the shelter because it was an all-women shelter, and they would be allowed to come in with smaller children, but not adult, young adolescent males. So that became a problem of sort of separating families. And one of the things that advocates began to focus on was having family shelters. And so it happened so quickly that I just was absolutely, absolutely frustrated and felt such a tremendous sense of sadness that the progression of it was feeling like if you had a wet box and you tried to put something in the box and you knew that the strength of the box, that corrugated sort of paper that boxes come in, that it was so saturated you could feel the bottom of the box giving away. And you knew that that whatever was in the box was going to hit the ground. And that was the sort of sense that I had about these children and adolescents that were coming in for all sorts of kinds of issues, stomach aches, headaches, difficulty focusing, and this is what the teachers were sending them to us for, or actually sending them if they were violent and aggressive. One of the things that's in place is that the teacher can then send the child to the principal, and they can actually send the kid to the ER if they're a danger to hurt themselves or others. So we saw lots of kids every day, anywhere from 11 o'clock to 5 o'clock, we just have a stream of kids coming in that we had to fully evaluate. And some of the things that we needed to do for them didn't have to do with psychotherapy or medication, but had to do with basic living, aspects of living, food, housing, clean clothes, quiet. Those are the kinds of things that we could not provide for them. And so a lot of these children were sent to family shelters and kind of just crowded into family shelters, and they're all over Boston, and it's become so bad that some of these people were placed in motels around Boston, usually sort of, you know, low income, sort of your one-star motel, those kind of places, two-star if they were lucky. And these motels were rented by the state to help with homeless people. So my point is chronic poverty and homelessness really can be a major stressor and contribute to some of the kinds of behaviors that we see in young adolescents, particularly adolescent males.
And can be behaviors associated with illness. Your initial point in this part of our conversation was that you believe that type of chronic poverty and homelessness can be an actual health trigger.
Can contribute to it, absolutely, absolutely. And the other thing is, I think it's disguised. That one of the things that becomes difficult is sort of sorting out how much of this is illness and how much of this is environmental factors that's contributing to this. There's sort of a synergy between the two, and if you want to tease out to see how much of these are factors, it becomes really difficult to assess mental illness because there are all these other things going on.
I was interested in your wet box image and your frustration about how it's like putting things in a wet box where it just falls through. Your work as a practitioner in Buddhist teaching and community experience, can we go to that and look at how the issues of self-care and care for others have been important to you in that Buddhist context? Can you give me a bit of a sense of that, please?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that certainly has been true for me and for other people that I've spoken to is that they have come to Buddhism after experiencing a certain kind of trauma or loss themselves. Something major in their life really brought them to a place where they felt like they had few resources. And in my own situation, I came to Buddhism in 1996, after the death of my father, and began to develop a mindfulness practice. And I probably should say a little bit about what mindfulness is before I might tell my story. So mindfulness has several definitions, and the one that I find most useful is that mindfulness is moment-to-moment awareness of the present without judgment. And so after the death of my father, in 1996. I had had four deaths before 1996 in a period of from 1992 to 1996. My mother died. My mentor, who was an African-American, a religious nun, died. Another older woman who was a mentor of mine who lived in Washington, D.C., died. And then I guess my father was the fourth person. But altogether, in a span of 5 years, I had four people die. And this brought me to my knees. And this is, you know, I am a teacher. I'm also a licensed psychologist. And so I thought I had the resources to kind of get through this. And I absolutely was grieving, very depressed, and just felt incredible. I felt orphaned. There's not a better word for it. Orphaned in the world. I have an older sister. But I went from feeling like I had a family to feeling like I had been dropped in a city all alone. My sister lives in Connecticut. I'm here in Boston. But I just felt unalone, unattached, and I have lots of friends and colleagues, but I felt a deeper sense of abandonment, almost. It just really triggered some things for me, and I was trying to figure out how I was going to get a handle on it. So obviously, psychotherapy was one route that I went. Once a week, 50 minutes talking about this. But I felt like I really wasn't making progress. And at that time, it was early enough that now there are a number of Buddhist psychologists that practice contemplative psychotherapy. But at that point, there weren't. So I did traditional psychotherapy and kind of looked at this stuff. And after a while, looking, I still was in a tremendous amount of pain. I still was working. I started working at Harvard Divinity School. I was doing but there was a sort of a deeper kind of yearning. A friend of mine said, well, why don't you go on a Buddhist retreat? I have a number of friends who had their own sets of challenges around family or loss or whatever, and they felt, you know, that this was going to be a good thing for me. I didn't do that much research. I trusted them, so I said, sure. And I went to Insight Meditation Center in Barre, Mass., which is a Vipassana type of meditation, a basic meditation where you're just kind of watching your breath and really, really working with your thoughts. It was a 7-day retreat. And I will tell you that retreat was an amazing thing. But it also took me to a place where I really had to deal with all the crazy thoughts that are in my head. And so one of the things one of the reasons why I think people find meditation challenging is that it's really mind training. You're working with your mind. You're working, the Buddhists call it monkey mind, the kinds of things that go through your head all the time. They might be making lists. They might be thinking about your appointments that you're going to have. You might be thinking about how much work you have to do. I might be thinking about what's your next vacation. And if you're quiet for any period of time, I mean, this doesn't happen to me now, but early on, if you're quiet for any period of time, your mind starts racing with these very insignificant things. It's just busy all the time, busy, busy, busy. And so that retreat was really helpful to me. And then in the middle of it, I remember at one point we were in the meditation hall, we were all meditating. This was right after someone had given a talk. And I remember really feeling like I was going to lose it. I got up from my cushion, I walked downstairs and stretched out on the floor below. It was an old bowling alley. It used to be the place where Insight Meditation is. It used to be a seminary for a Roman Catholic priest, and there was an old bowling alley that they left in place. And I just stretched out on the floor and just sobbed and sobbed and sobbed. I'm sure I must have been there for at least an hour and a half. I don't know what those tears were about, but they were so liberating. And so since 1996, I've been meditating. I've moved to Tibetan Buddhism in the last 3 years because I have a different teacher. And I have to say that I feel terrific, and I meditate every day. And one of the reasons that I really feel that it can be a really wonderful resource for the African-American community, particularly adolescents, is that the kind of mind training that you get is really working with your fears. And so you're looking at dealing with your fears, not by picking up a gun, but by facing your fears, you know, and also working with your attachments. When gang members talk about they own this section, so you can't walk in this section of town, we don't really own anything. None of us owns anything. So in fact, you're working with your fear, you're working with your sense of attachment, you're working with your desire, and realizing that all of these are delusions, that we create these things, we make these things up in our head so that they become real challenges for us. And the suffering that we experience in our head, the Buddhists call it heart-mind, but the suffering that we experience is the suffering that we've created for ourselves, so that we create situations that bring about our own suffering. And so when you think about gun violence or the kind of conflicts that young adolescents, particularly, you know, African-American males might have with each other around ownership of a certain part of town or ownership of a motorbike or any of those kinds of things. It's mostly territorial kind of thing of which section of the city, that kind of thing. Then being able to let go of that, and fearlessness is not, then doesn't become about a thing, you know, that I have, you know, an 8mm gun and I have 50 other guys that are part of my posse. But the fearlessness becomes about that I'm not afraid of having an open heart. I'm not afraid of compassion. I'm not afraid to be loving. So you see what I'm saying? It's a radical shift from what they're doing to really a place of really of what the Dalai Lama calls working with compassion in daily living.
That is a very deep image for how young people would eventually be able to take a sense of their own inner self into composure and peace within community, and then could presumably ripple out into a wider sense of communal peacefulness. I guess they're the sort of hopes you would have for that type of work with African-American adolescents. Would that be so?
Yes, yes. And I think, you know, one of the things is that we often, because there's such a high level of community violence at times, gang violence, gun violence, that we forget that these are adolescents, and that for most adolescents, the frontal cortex, the prefrontal cortex, the front of the brain, is not developed. And so we see that kind of impulsivity with adolescents across race and ethnicity. And so something like mindfulness meditation can really be helpful for adolescents in general to try to calm them down, center them, and really help them understand that and see that things are changing all the time.
What about the relationship of mindfulness meditation with a mental illness such as schizophrenia? Where does the application apply, if at all, in that setting?
Well, I'm not sure it applies. I know there's been some work done with mindfulness and depression. But even with depression, I think it needs to be carefully done. Some of the research suggests that meditation can actually increase someone's depression. In something like schizophrenia, where the person's thoughts are They have disordered thinking, their reality testing, you know, their judgment of what's real or not real is challenged. Being present in moment to moment is going to be really difficult for them. So I don't think that mindfulness meditation is a resource. I think mindfulness meditation and prayer certainly would be two of the things that probably aren't going to be a resource. Maybe worship might be a resource for somebody actually going through a ritual, going through a mass or something like that. But I think generally the person would have a pretty difficult time trying to pay attention to those kinds of spiritual practices.
With respect to schizophrenia, as we are aware, there's issues of hallucinations, or auditory in particular with hearing mm-hmm. voices, delusions. Mm-hmm. In mm-hmm. your experience, speaking now more generally in your clinical practice, have you noticed the way in which any religious context or culture has influence the type of hallucination or the type of instructions or impact of the voices?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In the emergency room, there was one time where we had a Latino adolescent come in who was quite psychotic and had a lot of religious imagery about God and sort of being saved, sort of a lot of grandiosity. And one of the things we needed to tease out was to what extent was this a psychotic experience? And if so, was it fueled by medication or drugs or something, you know, trying to get some sense of that? Or to what extent was this a combination of that included some cultural factors, because her own family was involved in Catholicism, but also other kinds of worship practices from Puerto Rico. So it made it a little bit difficult for us to sort out. I think we ultimately came to the conclusion that in terms of reality testing, what's real, what's not real, that it was a psychotic experience for this, or a psychotic episode for this young woman. And it was never clear to us whether it was triggered by the family's religious beliefs, or if the family's religious, it was triggered by something else, and then the family's religious beliefs also were playing into her psychosis. But nevertheless, I think one of the things that's really became important as we were doing this was really trying to think about the context in which we were seeing children and adolescents, but also their sort of racial ethnic history, the sort of medical factors that might be included in this, as well as family medical history and family history of psychiatric behaviors or family psychiatric history, which sometimes people aren't that willing to give that information out. And it's really vital in trying to construct a picture of what you think you are seeing at that point.
One of the things that's important for me as I've prepared for this encounter on ABC Radio National is the role of the churches in Australia as, for the most part, supportive and constructive allies in supporting people with mental illness and schizophrenia in particular for my inquiries. And I've worked with some groups with the Catholic Church, for instance, where there's a lot mm-hmm. of non-judgmental, very caring support mm-hmm. available mm-hmm. and so on. I'm wondering, within the Buddhist community in the United States, which you're familiar with from your own practice, if support networks of that kind are developing, or if you can give me an example, please.
Well, yes. I know less about this, but generally, in fact, we have a couple of people that in our own sangha that are struggling with trauma and other kinds of things. But the more serious mental illness like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, I'm not sure how much is being done. I think the whole question of acceptance is a big one. In our own sangha and many throughout the country, there's a kind of ways of being organized to help people that need particular attention. So in our sangha, we call it sangha care, and it's for people who have family members or relatives that are dying or need attention around hospice care. But it's also for people that have other kinds of disabilities. It might be somebody that's had a heart attack that needs a ride to the doctor. And in that group, we have a couple of people who are struggling with major depression and need other kinds of support. So one of the ways I think Buddhist communities have organized themselves is around also creating within their own sanghas ways to be aware of and accepting and responding to people who have needs in their own communities. One of the larger things for me, and I don't know how well we do this in the Buddhist community, is the whole question of domestic violence is one that I think the church, and I grew up Roman Catholic and was a practicing Roman Catholic for many, many years, and came pretty close to going into the convent. But still, the people that I talk to tell me that domestic violence is still not dealt with in most churches, and they're ill-equipped to deal with it, and they just kind of take a standoff kind of attitude about it.
Your forthcoming book, Buddhist Spiritual Care, to be released this year, and your own experience in palliative care, supporting people who are dying. One final comment on that, please.
The book is called The Arts of Contemplative Care, Pioneering Voices in Buddhist Chaplaincy and Pastoral Work. And it's a collection of about 30 authors, Rusty Joan Halifax, and any number of significant people that are at the cutting edge of the field. And the book largely focuses on how do you develop compassionate care for caregivers. And in that, a lot of the focus is on what chaplaincy looks like. What do we even mean by contemplative care? What do we mean by compassionate care? And one of the things that Rashi Joan Halifax, who is a Zen priest and is the priest at Upaya Zen Center in New Mexico, talks about, she has a phrase called strong back, soft front. And the strong back, our spine, is balance, is equanimity. But we also need a soft front. And the soft front is our open-heartedness. So compassionate care requires equanimity or balance and a kind of open-heartedness as we work to try to make space for people in a mindful way. And the book largely is a series of chapters in which the authors reflect on variations of that theme.